After the Reformation, the 17th and 18th centuries witnessed a new phenomenon in the church, denominations.
In the Middle Ages, there wasn't tolerance for religious dissent. Pretty much everybody was obligated to be part of the one true church. The state used its authority to force you into the one true church. But now, how do we tolerate one another? How do we learn to get along in a divided world?
People didn't know how to react to this new diversity of thought that followed the Reformation. As we'll discover today, the result was further splintering over various points of doctrine and practice. Thanks for listening to Renewing Your Mind. Dr. W. Robert Godfrey is guiding us through church history on the Saturday edition of the program, and today we'll move into a new time period, the 17th and 18th centuries. Here's Dr. Godfrey on the continuing Reformation.
Welcome to our fourth series on church history. We have looked in our first series at the ancient church, in our second series at the medieval church, in our third series at the Reformation church. And since I'm a Reformation historian, I don't really see the need to go on, but some people think there is life after the 16th century, so we will go on. And in this fourth series, we're going to be looking at the 17th and 18th centuries. And for those of you who are quick, you will immediately figure out that means the fifth series will be on the 19th and 20th centuries. So what we want to look at is how the church developed in the 17th and 18th centuries. You may think that since we're getting closer to the contemporary world, this whole process will become easier since maybe we'll be talking about more familiar things. We know more about that era because it's closer to us. But in fact, at least for me, I find it somewhat more difficult the closer we get to the present. In part because the church begins to diversify in amazing ways. It diversifies theologically. It diversifies geographically. It diversifies culturally. There are so many new things that are happening as we move into the modern world that, in fact, it's harder to focus, to decide what's happening to the church as a whole and to cover all of these disparate developments in the life of the church. And so we won't do everything. We haven't done everything all the way along anyway. But I thought I'd warn you at the outset that what we're going to do is primarily focus as we go along now on the development of the church that will be of particular interest to Ligonier people. That is particularly on the development of the evangelical and reformed part of the church. Now, that part of the church never develops, never thinks, never operates in isolation from the rest of the church. And so we'll be talking about other elements of the church as well as we go along. But that'll be our particular focus from now on in the next two periods. And one way of thinking about the church after the Reformation is to think of it in terms of a church wanting to continue the Reformation. How do we take the great foundation laid by the reformers and continue to build on it, continue to purify the church, continue to discipline the church, continue to develop the church, continue to grow the church? All of those things in many ways are a way of continuing the Reformation. But it's not just a matter of continuing the Reformation, because the church is going to face new challenges. Change happens. Some of us, at least if you're like me, are sometimes annoyed that changes happen. I saw a young man in the elevator with his jeans turned up into cuffs. When I was in junior high, we stopped doing that and thought that anybody that did that was really out of it. And now all of a sudden, it's back in. Only some 55 years later, I don't know how much, about 55 years later. Things change. You can't stop them from changing. And that's true for the church. It's true for Christian people. The world changes and the church changes. And I guess that's what keeps church historians in business, thinking about what change means, how we relate to it, what changes are positive, what changes are negative. And The church, certainly in the 17th century, began to face new challenges. And we can think about those new challenges in five different areas. I thought that was a good number to come up with. These are not the 5 points of Calvinism, but they are the five new challenges that the church faces in the 17th century. They're new geographical challenges. Now, we know that Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, but the impact of the new world came rather slowly into Europe. And it was not just the new world of what today we would call North and South America, but it was also the expanded world of Africa and of Asia, parts of the world that in the Middle Ages, Europeans had only a very vague notion existed, and of course had no notion that North and South America existed. Even by the early 17th century, most Europeans, even educated Europeans, were only dimly aware of how vast the world really was. A Dutch Reformed theologian in the early 17th century, very concerned about missions, a beginning concern at that time, said, "We have to be concerned about missions. There's a whole third of the world yet to be reached." Now, of course, today we talk about North America and the Europeans as one third of the world, and we talk about two-thirds world out there. But that's how little the Europeans really understood at the time, that the world was a much bigger place than they fully realized. And that's part of the challenge that will grow as Europeans begin to reach out to the New World and to the African and Asian continents, and the challenge that will pose, challenge to missions, a challenge to commerce, and later the challenge of colonialism, but also the challenge of realizing how many people in the world have never heard about Christ. What does that mean for our sense that Christ is Lord of Lords and King of Kings? How do we factor that in to our appreciation of the world and what is going on with the world? So the first new challenge stems from geography and the expanded connection to the physical world that Europeans were beginning to experience. And then, of course, there will be new political challenges. The 17th century will be a time in which monarchs are flexing their muscles, or at least trying to. In the Middle Ages, there continued to be something of a commitment to the idea of a universal empire. One emperor with others under him never really actually existed, but it was kind of the way people thought about how the world ought to be and how nations ought to be connected or peoples ought to be connected to one another. But by the 17th century, the ideal of universal empire is really fading, and nations are becoming much more important. And therefore, monarchs are becoming much more important. And monarchs are increasingly wanting to have complete authority in their own hands. In the Middle Ages, monarchs were usually limited. They were limited practically by other great nobility. And they were also limited often by what we would call parliaments, that is, gathering of representatives of various parts of the people from whom the monarch had to get permission, usually to raise taxes and to raise armies. But now in the 17th century, monarchs are beginning to think, wouldn't it be great to govern without parliaments and without being beholden to these great nobility? Let's reduce the power of the great nobility and let's get rid of parliaments if we can and govern by divine right. Queen of England's motto, still in French, interestingly enough, is God and my right. Kings of England never quite accomplished that, but that was the ideal, you see. God has given me as monarch right to rule by divine right. And this is called absolutism. The monarch is absolute ruler. And as monarchs tried to move in that direction, guess what? There was pushback. There was resistance. And so part of the political dynamic of the 17th and on into the 18th century was this political tension between monarchs and other forces in society, who would rule the nation? Would absolutism triumph, or would other forces in the society triumph? So we have geographical tensions, we have political tensions, we have, of course, a whole new challenge of a divided church. Up until the Reformation, by and large, certainly in the West, there had been one united institutional church. Didn't mean everybody agreed about everything, but at least theoretically, the institution of the church was united. Now the institution of the church is divided. There's still, of course, the Roman Catholic Church, and there are the Lutheran churches, and there are the Reformed churches, including the Presbyterians in Scotland. But there are also growing other groups, particularly the Anabaptists in the 16th century, but over time other groups as well. What does this mean for the way in which Christians think about the church? In the 16th century, when Christians thought about the church, and as the church began to divide, Christians basically thought in terms of the true church and the false church. And what that meant, of course, is mine is the true church and yours is the false church. And when the struggle seemed just to be between the Roman Catholic Church and the Protestant Church, that twofold division seemed to make sense. But did the Reformed really want to say the Lutherans were a false church? See, there's pressure now to begin to think, how do we process this? How do we account for this? Are there different ways of understanding the unity of the church, the dividedness of the church? This will eventually lead to what today we think of as denominational thinking. We take denominations so for granted we hardly think about it. Particularly if we're Protestants, that's the way we're sort of conditioned to think in America. I'm Dutch Reformed, you're a Presbyterian, you're a Baptist. I know my church is a little bit better than all of yours, but I don't want to say you're part of a false church. So we begin to talk about purer and less pure churches. And we begin to say, well, the true church of Jesus Christ can exist in different institutional forms. And that's a revolution in thinking. It's hard for us to appreciate that because we're so accustomed to it. It's a revolution in thinking. That's one of the things that begins to change, and it raises the whole question then of tolerance. In the Middle Ages, there wasn't tolerance for religious dissent. Everybody was obligated, pretty much everybody, there are exceptions. We can't go into exceptions here. We don't have time. But pretty much everybody was obligated to be part of the one true church. The state used its authority to force you into the one true church. But now, with the dividedness of things, should the state still try to force everybody into the one true church? Or how do we tolerate one another? How do we learn to get along in a divided world? That's a whole new experience for Europeans in the 17th century. And so we really are moving in a more modern direction, but it means breaking away with a lot of ideas and attitudes that had dominated Christian thinking for a millennium and a half. Calvin would never have agreed there ought to be any other church in Geneva except the Reformed Church. Once you get it right, why would you let anybody else come in and get it wrong? It's almost a public health issue in the 16th century. Heresy is a disease of the soul. You want to eradicate it. Doesn't that make sense? You want to inoculate people against it. But when it became clear you couldn't eradicate false views, then how do you come to grips with that? How do you learn to live with one another? How do you learn to get along? So that's the third point, the new challenge of a divided church. Then the fourth point, what holds culture together? What is the glue that serves as the foundation of a society? In Europe, one could really say for its whole history, even before Christianity came along, religion was the glue that held society together. Now, that doesn't mean everybody was equally religious. It didn't mean everybody was sincerely religious. I've often said I think the biggest religion in the history of the world is formalism. You just sort of go along with what everybody else is doing. But it was religion that could be appealed to. It was religion that provided the sort of intellectual framework of how the world made sense and what were the foundations of morality. And now all of a sudden, the church, as a unified institution that had been the guardian of that cultural glue that held society together, now is broken. What will hold us together? Well, for a while, people said, well, kind of basic Christianity, what we all believe together, that can hold us together. But increasingly, that basic Christian message became vaguer, more uncertain. What holds us together? What are the common values that we still hold through? The 17th century spent a lot of time talking about natural law. If we're not united on what revealed law means, maybe we can be united about natural law, what's available to human reason that we can all agree. We all have reason. And so if we can all reason out what natural law is teaching, that maybe can be the foundation and the glue that can hold society together. But you see the problem, the new challenge. What's the cultural glue that holds us together? America sort of experiences that today, doesn't it? Various ethical issues, various political issues are raised today. And some of us who hold to the old glue that held us together say, how can these things be changing? And the new people say, yeah, but who has to agree with you? And we're left wondering, what's going to hold us together? What do we still have in common? What will unite us? That was a problem that began to be voiced, began to be sensed in the 17th century already, and would become more and more a problem as the 18th and 19th century wore on, with new philosophical, sometimes anti-Christian teaching, leading into the Enlightenment, and also with new scientific discoveries, particularly in the 18th, 19th century, that would put pressure on Christians and receive Christian understandings. So it's a new challenge. How are Christians going to relate to this new world? How's the church going to relate to it? And then fifthly, there's just theology itself. It's not only that the institution of the church was divided, but there are so many theological voices being articulated. And new challenges. Protestants, for example, found themselves by the late 16th, early 17th century really being challenged by renewal in the Roman Catholic Church. Maybe we are in a position to understand that a little bit today with the sudden popularity of Pope Francis. There's a kind of new energy in the Roman Catholic Church. I was thinking, as I was watching some television over Christmas time, that there was a day not so very long ago, a couple of decades ago, where if the news media wanted a kind of religious statement for Christmas, they went to Billy Graham. Billy Graham was sort of the voice of American religion. Now, everybody knew not everybody agreed with Billy Graham, but Billy Graham was sort of the public face of American religion. And it struck me that today, by and large, when the media want a public face for religion, they go to some Roman Catholic cardinal, preferably Cardinal Dolan in New York, because they don't have to travel very far. The media just goes down the street in Manhattan. And it struck me how things have changed in America. For the first time in history, there is no Protestant on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is all Jewish and Roman Catholic justices. What only 50 years ago, when John Fitzgerald Kennedy was running for president, he had to publicly explain how it was possible even to think about having a Roman Catholic as president of the United States. That's amazing today. Young people can't probably believe such a world existed. But America in 1960 was such a Protestant country, Roman Catholicism was still seen as a kind of foreign element. Today, it's almost the Protestants who are the foreigners. I'm not making any point about that, even though Rome is a false church. I'm not making any point about that except to say things have really changed because Protestantism is in decline. You know, who do we ask to be a Protestant voice? Rick Warren to talk about weight loss? Who's the Protestant voice? Rome is revived. Rome is energetic. Same thing happened late 16th, early 17th century. Suddenly, there were brilliant theologians in the Roman Church, seriously challenging received Protestant teaching. When Luther and Calvin came along and their immediate followers, Protestant leaders were so much better educated than Roman Catholic leaders, it was sort of like, you know, a great army marching into a country that was undefended. But by the late 16th, early 17th century, Rome is revived. Rome is robust. The most famous of their theologians, Robert Bellarmine, wrote a great three-volume work called The Controversies, in which he went point by point with great learning and great insight into the Bible and history and theology to answer the Protestants. In the years after Robert Bellarmine, over 200 Protestant answers to him were written because his critique of Protestantism was seen to be so powerful and in some ways so devastating, he had to be answered. Beza said that Robert Bellarmine was sort of the Augean stables, full of so much dung it was almost impossible to clear out. But it was a huge challenge. This required a whole new intellectual approach to the defense of the faith, a much more technical defense of the faith. You go back and read Calvin. Calvin is very readable. Calvin wasn't a popular theologian. He didn't dumb it down, but he's very readable in the way that he writes. But by the 17th century, theology had become so technical that it became very difficult to read. And it wasn't just renewed Rome. It was renewed Lutheranism that challenged the Reformed, renewed Reformed that challenged the Lutherans and the Roman Catholics, a whole new branch of theology called Socinianism, named after Faustus Socinus. Socinianism was really a kind of anticipation of liberalism. It began to doubt the authority of Scripture. It doubted the divinity of Christ. But Socinus was also a very bright man who had to be answered. And so we see a world of new challenges. And that's what we're going to be talking about. And as we bring this lecture to a conclusion, I still would like to say I would prefer to live in the 16th century, except for antibiotics and toilets. The new challenges are exciting, and we're going to enjoy taking a look at those together.
Well, as you can readily tell, Dr. Robert Godfrey brings a sense of humor to his ability to teach church history, and we're grateful for him. You've been listening to another lesson in his series, A Survey of Church History. Over the course of 73 lessons, Dr. Godfrey carefully explained the timeline of church history from the Book of Acts all the way to the modern times. We placed all of these lessons together in a 12 DVD set, and we'd like to send them to you for your gift of any amount today. Simply contact us at renewingyourmind.org, or you can call us and give your gift at 800-435-4343. The 17th century saw a rise in what's known as scholasticism. Schools and libraries flourished, and as a result, theological precision was required. So we can be thankful for the faithful scholars in this time period. We benefit today from their careful study of Scripture. Dr. Godfrey's series is a great place to increase our own knowledge. For your gift of any amount, we will send you all 73 lessons on 12 DVDs. Again, our phone number is 800-435-4343, where you can make your request at renewingyourmind.org. Well, let me remind you before we go to tune in to another of Ligonier's many resources, RefNet. It's our 24/7 internet radio station. We feature the ministries of faithful men like Alistair Begg, John MacArthur, and John Piper. Plus, you'll hear Bible readings, music, and Christian audiobooks. You can listen for free at refnet.fm or download the free RefNet app. Next weekend, Dr. Godfrey continues our series. We'll return to the 17th century to find out how the rise of scholastic theology affected the church. So join us next Saturday for Renewing Your Mind.